Okay, we'll see what questions we got. Okay. During my meditation, I can occasionally calm the mind to the point where it seems devoid of thought. It is temporary, like a door opening. How should I use this opportunity? Concentrate on the breath? Wait for thoughts to arise and watch them? Explore/investigate a topic that is causing my suffering? Other question marks? Yes. One has to experiment and see what's useful, what's beneficial, what helps the mind. Because sometimes, say like being devoid of thought, sometimes that's very peaceful and clear and spacious, and sometimes it's just devoid of thought. It is kind of and not very clear, so that one has to get a feel for. I think one of the things that's helpful to remember is the nature of wholesome mental states and the nature of unwholesome mental states. In Pali, it's the kusala and akusala jitta. And of course, what we're trying to do is nurture and encourage the kusala dhammas. And the nature of kusala is that there is a steadiness or a calmness, clarity. There's stillness and as opposed to restlessness. So calm as opposed to agitation. There's a certain discernment and clarity of discernment as opposed to confusion. There's the quality of well-being as opposed to suffering. So that intrinsic to those mental states, they have that. Of this particular quality, so that sometimes the actual concentration is, or attending to the meditation object is a skillful tool to be applying that helps those fostering of the kusala jitta. Sometimes the attention to the thought patterns is helpful. Sometimes the investigation of a particular obstacle, hindrance, suffering is helpful. Sometimes attending to something that's really inspiring, brightening is important. So one has to experiment, and all of them will be applied at different times as one gains skill. So that's the I think one of the things that's important is trusting oneself to cultivate the skill and gain confidence in one's cultivation of that skill and practice. This is actually quite, on a certain level, ditto the answer. With all of many excellent frames of reference the Buddha has given us to understand our experience, it can be confusing to know which to use when. And do you recommend training systematically or letting one's intuition guide the focus? So I think, again, one has to trust oneself. So often we're we want some authority outside of ourselves who can categorically sort of explain and tell us what to do, so we don't have to doubt, so that sense of our experience is what guides us. Okay. Can you please speak a little a little more about the process of bringing in a wholesome, brightening reflection into the meditation? This morning you spoke about using directed thought evaluation to explore the primary object, the breath, then bring in the brightening object. In this way, the attention shifts back and forth from breath to bright object, ? Should one use this reflection often? Always? Please speak about this process. This is, again, it's one's paying attention to what works. These are our tools as opposed to belief systems that the Buddha is giving us, and so that learning how to use the tools. If the attention to the breath helps the mind to be bright and clear and discerning, then that's sufficient. If there's there's a kind of drifting or some kind of obstacle arises, then bringing some other object that helps the mind to brighten, so that the reflection on the one that I gave as bringing to mind the recollection of the Buddha, something that can inspire the mind, and one can that it just is allowing our kind of faith quality to kick in to the mind, allowing a sense of delight in possibility that the Buddha manifests as an image, bringing to mind the qualities of, very consciously bringing to mind the qualities of loving kindness or compassion, and that tends to brighten the mind. Or bringing to just perception of light, and that brightens the mind. So that just consciously directing attention to that sense of brightness, spaciousness. Those are reflections that one uses in order to create that sense of balance, or the sense of that quality that I spoke about, or spoke about a couple times now, with the just right, and that sense of oh, the mind is sort of feels just right. It's at ease. It's comfortable. It's clear. It's steady. There's a nice balance there, so that you're using the tools to help to foster that quality of balance. And you know, you're really having to adjust from time to time, and sometimes it's extraneous, it's unnecessary. It's like I remember Ajahn Chah one time saying, yeah, well, you know, if the mind is already clear and alert and, you know, is actually really in the imbued with this quality of knowing, you don't have to be saying, using Bhutto, because Bhutto literally means the one who knows. You know, so you don't have to say it, you're already doing it. So and similarly, you know, you're using the tools for a specific purpose, and if that purpose is accomplished, then it's not essential, but it's just gaining skill in how to apply that. And I said, as mentioning a couple times, learning how to trust yourself. It's really, I think that's an important part of it. Okay. I've enjoyed practicing with connecting the breath to whatever is conditioning the mind. Twice, however, when evaluating, I've come across something new. A plain, white, fizzy, effervescing barrier. It's not unfriendly, and I can feel a faint tug from whatever is behind it, but that's as far as I get. Have my sankharas developed a new stealth technology? Are they allowed to do that? You better believe it. They can do anything. Any advice on how to proceed? Yeah. Or secret passwords? a lot of it is again being willing to be present with that feeling, because there's something like this, okay, it's plain white, fizzy, it's a barrier, it's not unfriendly, but learning how to stay with that and see what happens, and just because sometimes something that's kind of indistinct is if it feels that there's something sort of behind it, it doesn't necessarily mean that there actually is anything behind it, but to be patient and curious, right? That quality of taking an interest in it, because one can still be, it doesn't have to be a primary object. The primary object can still be the breath and the connecting with that perception, the feeling, and then by taking an interest in it, then, you know, either it reveals itself or it doesn't, and one can go on to something else. And you can still bring it up again, come back to it at another time, but it's sort of like being willing to stay with it for a while and see if anything kind of changes, or what the feeling around it is. Because a lot of that is, you know, in terms of the password is usually patience. uh, As I understand it, it is rare and fortunate to have a human birth because of the amount of suffering in the human realm that may lead one to practice to end suffering. On the other hand, devas have less suffering, and therefore they would be less motivated to practice to end suffering. Is this correct? If so, would it not be better for one to wish oneself and others to be reborn in the human realm if one aspires to full liberation? Yeah, absolutely. It's a but also to and setting aspirations, then it's also setting aspirations for human realm, but also circumstances where that are supportive of practicing the Dhamma, because that again, that's a it's one of the reasons, like in say like in Thai culture. When you you make offerings, do meritorious deeds, one of the logic behind, or the aspiration behind, is creating affinities with particular being circumstances, so that one is drawn over, like if we're looking over time, that one would be drawn back to those circumstances that one had, and people that one had created those affinities with. And that is facilitating, again, that process of fulfilling aspiration over the long term, over series of rebirths, and drawing close to those who can support one in one's practice of Dhamma. When you described deity yesterday, it was different than how I think of it. Sometimes I get a feeling of a great expanse of happiness, like the realization that this practice actually works. It's exciting and empowering, but I'm not jumping up and down. It's a combination of the mind settling and opening. Is that a cousin of piti? Does piti only happen in meditation? There's actually in the commentaries, there's five different kinds of piti, and they love lists, right? So that it ranges from minor tingling up to the spectacular, all of it is the word piti has many manifestations, and certainly it doesn't only happen in meditation. It happens in very ordinary circumstances, or ordinary in the sense of external circumstances, walking, sitting, standing, lying down. I mean, any posture, anywhere where the mind is delighted and has an exhilaration to it. But certainly with something the piti associated with Dhamma is a helpful basis for energizing practice so that those are qualities that arise in the mind as we study, practice, or see examples of people living the Dhamma. Okay, dear Lumpa, thank you for these wonderful teachings. I understand that, quote unquote, citta is both the heart and mind, but my felt experience is often so different. My mind is often crabby and critical and downright mean, at least to me, but my heart is soft and sweet and easily moved. In fact, my mind can make my heart cry. Please help with this dilemma. Same owner. It's learning how to live together. It's a... that's kind of the realizing that we inhabit the jitta, we inhabit the same space. So it's learning how to live together, learning how to communicate. That's the function of our practice is learning how these different seemingly disparate qualities that we embody, what their place is, how do we live together, how do we communicate and balance free ourselves from suffering. I know parting with loved ones is natural cause of life, but deep sadness and grief arises when I reflect on that. Could you instruct on how to work with this grief? Is there a level of understanding when there is no grief? A lot of it is just being willing to contemplate it. It's like the Buddha has us, like there's one of the chants that we do, and that's to be, it's called Abhinna Pachawekana, so it's like to be reflected on frequently and as much as one can. That's the five reflections. I am of the nature to age. I've not gone beyond aging. I'm of the nature to sicken. I've not gone beyond sickness. I'm of the nature to die. I've not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And then I'm the owner of my kamma, heir to my kamma, born of my kamma, related to my kamma, abide, supported by my kamma. All that is mine, we reap the fruits of our karma. So that that reflection, it's like reminding ourselves, because it is something that goes against the grain. It goes against our wishes, our desires, our hopes, but it's like standing outside and wishing that the sun wouldn't set. You just want to have daytime all the time. It ain't gonna happen. So that similarly separation from the loved is it's inevitable, and that's not any just sort of trying to rub your nose in it to make you miserable, but it's entertaining the realities of what we have to live with, and that we that is impossible to escape. So that when we're able to allow that, but that reflecting on it, then there, we experience a sadness and grief because we don't want it to be that way. But then, because of that experience, then on a rational level, we can sort of say, well, we can start to figure that out. On a rational basis, everybody, everything has to die. Everybody, everything has to be separated from what they love. But it takes a while, and oftentimes a long while, for the heart to really accept that, so that. To be willing to contemplate that, because what that does is then give us a kind of a stability and strength that allows us to deal skillfully and kindly with the realities of our existence, rather than being reactive through fear or aversion, so that there's a much more positive response, and there certainly is a level of understanding where there is no grief, I think of the the stories of the Buddha encouraging. I brought one up the other day of when Ananda was experiencing the separation from Sariputta when Sariputta passed away. The Buddha encouraging him. But, I don't think that means that the Buddha didn't ever feel anything. Because in the same way, at that same sort of time period, it was probably within a year, both Sariputta and Mahamoggallana passed away. And and the Buddha was it was toward the end of the Buddha's life. He'd have been probably in his late 70s. He passed away when he was 80. He was in his late 70s probably. And there's a discourse where the Buddha is sitting with the Sangha, and he just makes a mention of now that Sariputta and Mahamoggallana passed away, it seems that the assembly is kind of empty, so that it's and then the Buddha goes on to instruct, and so he's not overwhelmed by grief, but it's sort of like, it's not unfeeling, it's not uncognizant of the reality of the Sangha missing two of its greatest elders. Or I remember one. Walking at in the nun section at Wat Pa Pong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, with Ajahn Chah. And it was either shortly after, sometime after his mother passed away or after the funeral ceremony. Because his Ajahn Chah's mother was the head nun of Wat Pa Pong as well. So it was a family business. There, and and we were walking with another monk and the parents of that monk, and he was saying, yeah, it feels very different walking in the nun section with my mother not here. And he said, and then he sort of said, yeah, you know, now I'm an orphan. Yes, it was. But, yeah, it was not unfeeling, uncognizant, but it's also held skillfully. Okay, three questions. One, what is meant by releasing the mind? This is I think from the Anapanasati Sutta. I think there's some copies of it have been put up and it's starting to circulate. What is meant by releasing the mind? Releasing it from any hindrance? Can you please illustrate with examples? In this sense, you know, well, also, you know, sometimes the Buddha's use of language was incredibly precise, and sometimes there's, you know, layers of interpretation that can be applied to it. In this sense, usually what is meant by releasing the mind is more the releasing in terms of hindrances and obstacles to, say, to concentration, to clarity, to stillness, as opposed to releasing the mind in full, complete enlightenment. Although it could, one could interpret it there, because the word has both those meanings. Vimocha yang has both those meanings, but generally how it's interpreted is the releasing of hindrances or obstacles, so that anything that creates agitation in the mind or a ripples in the mind, because it's preceded by the step of concentrating the mind, samodha yang, so that's establishing samadhi. And then the next step is releasing the mind, so that it's sort of, okay, if there's still any hindrances coming up, still any agitation, still any obstacle, and it could be some. At this point, it's more subtle, especially at the in the progression or the assumed progression of this discourse. A lot of the coarser hindrances and defilements are released or let go of, dealt with at the point of the at the body, bodily settling, establishing a continuity of attention, awareness, a modicum or fair establishing of of concentration or samadhi at that point. But then, you know, you're still working with refinements and working with what the mind throws up, so that attending to the more subtle manifestations of, say, of hindrances and you know, just something, or if it is coarse, and maybe one wants to release the mind from that as well. So if it's, you know, some just, but usually it's more around more subtle aspects of maybe some irritation or some kind of restlessness, or some kind of wavering in the mind, so that tends to be able to be settled at that point. And because the mind is, at that point, is, say, in the progression of the sutta, the mind is preparing for insight and penetrative insight. The second question, how is calming mental fabrication different from releasing the mind? Any examples to illustrate? Well, calming mental fabrication is the calming of a feeling and perception, the more like the roots of the movement of the mind, the associative qualities, and it's, I think it's, there's probably not not necessarily a huge difference between the two. But I think the calming the mental fabrications is a bit more primary, in the sense of really understanding the process of how the mind starts moving, and how feeling and perception hold sway over the mind. So that releasing the mind is probably a bit more working with more subtle aspects of the mind, and that calming the mental fabrications is finding ways to settle, calm, and understanding that process of how the mind is, that movement of mind is built. What's the engine that drives it? And then the last one, when mental fabrication causes a bodily or verbal fabrication, such as anxiety or sensual desire, is it too late to breathe and calm fabrications? Not at all. It's always never too late to breathe. So always coming back to the breath is such a it's kind of like a relief, an anchor. It's you're back to an old friend, and it's like home territory, and so rather than being dragged off with the kind of the various fabrications and complications and proliferations that the mind can spin out. Okay, it comes back to that anchor of the breath. And so, wow, what a relief. Okay, how do you use mindfulness of breathing when you're doing a recollection? Do you first use mindfulness of breathing to settle the mind, body, and then turn your attention to the recollection? Is the awareness of breathing in the background? That with mindfulness, especially with that cultivation of mindfulness of breathing, then it's learning to have that, yeah, that process and awareness of the breath as really the background, the anchor that one is steeped in. And one sees in the refrain of the discourse on mindfulness of breathing, contemplating or investigating impermanence, I breathe in, contemplating, I breathe out, the experiencing Citta Sankara, I breathe in, experiencing the Citta Sankara, I breathe out. So that they all of those stages or steps in the investigation, attending to, experience, the breath is there in the background. There might be times when there's an investigation or a recollection that is compelling, and one directs attention to that a bit more overtly or consciously. But it's having used that mindfulness of breathing as a basis, then you can direct attention to a recollection. If the mind is starting to spin out, or it's getting complicated, or it doesn't seem to be accomplishing a point, then returning to the breath again. There is that opportunity to set the mindfulness of breathing aside if it feels like there's a compelling reason, something that is useful or beneficial. But in general, we can chew gum and walk down the street at the same time, you know. You can pay attention to the breath and be attentive to experience as well. One can direct the mind with the breath as an anchor as well. So it's not hard and fast, and what is important is, okay, what works? What helps the mind to take an interest and to settle, become clear, and to incline to discernment. Okay. Should I focus on one object of mindfulness at a time, or can I be mindful of all four at one time? That would be difficult. In a sense of all four at one time. On a certain level, it's all four is happening anyway, but if you try to how can I be mindful of all four things at one time? I think your head will explode. And, you know, it's really important that the practice of mindfulness and the development of the practice is something that is easeful and helps clarity and discernment. So that to not make things too complicated, making things more simple is really takes a certain effort. I think we're quite adept at making things complicated, overt, conscious attempts to really simplify, let things become simpler and simpler. That's a uh, uh, there's a lot of ease and joy that comes from that. Okay. You mentioned quote-unquote inner confidence. Can you describe it more in detail and the ways to cultivate it? I think a lot of what I've been talking about, all right from the first question, has been around this inner confidence, and a lot of it is just through experience, and then a certain trust in oneself, and trust that we have our own. We've got the means by which we can understand the Buddha's teachings. We can understand the true nature of existence. We have all of that. That capability of awakening is what. How the Buddha in the sense that say the Buddha's life and his example is an example to us, in the sense that he didn't become enlightened because he was born in some celestial realm, or he was some kind of celestial being of some sort, but it is the because he was a human being with a body, a mind that can discern what's skillful, what's unskillful, what's beneficial, what's not beneficial, is able to do that. There's a discourse where the Buddha says he's still unenlightened, and he's using the categories of what's actually skillful, what's not skillful, what's wholesome, what's not what's unwholesome, and just using that category, and that's. He's not sort of contemplating some abstruse aspect of ethereal realms of existence. It's about our ordinary day-to-day life, our experience, our bodies, our minds, and how to free the heart from suffering. So that's a. That kind of trust in that, and that we have that capability. So that's where that inner confidence comes. That all of the from the time of the Buddha, all of the beings who have realized the fruits of this practice. They're ordinary human beings. I was thought of that the other night. One of the reasons that made me think of it is I gave a story. I told a story about Lumpu Khao, and there's this great master, great being. And I thought about it after, and because sometimes we think, that's just, it's kind of historical, something else, somewhere else, somebody else. But it's Mook's uncle. There's one of the women here who's here. It's his uncle. And she started going to, Mook started going to Wat Pho Mun. She was a little girl. And contact with Ajahn Chah. Just saying, she saw Ajahn Sumedho when he first showed up at Wat Pho Phong. So it's just about real human beings. And, you know, even these great beings that we respect. Yeah, I mean, they're somebody's son. They're somebody's uncle. They're somebody's... Actually, I mean, they're somebody's father. I mean, Lumpu Khao had a family before he ordained. So, you know, these are real human beings. It's not... So that is, I think it's an important part to not make it so distant from our experience and reality.
Dear Ajahn Kurunadamo, could you say a bit more about how you find a belief in rebirth to be motivational and that it, quote, just makes sense, unquote? Do you think perhaps about the person who will inherit your rebirth and how it would be good to load them up with good karma? Thanks. Let's see. I got to turn on my verbal mode here. I've been in my listening mode. As I was saying earlier, I don't have the ability to say I know firsthand about rebirth, but that sense that it... It makes sense that I can see rebirth happening every moment through the day. You know, in my own experience, how different actions have different results. And if I attend to things in a skillful way and attend to qualities of mind that are wholesome, then I can see the results of that in my own mind, my own heart. So that's kind of just knowing the law of karma from one minute to the next, it just seems to me that it's only logical that that momentum isn't something that all of a sudden just completely stops when the body dies. My own personal experience is that there is more to my experience than the body, that the mind and the experience of all the aspects of mind, citta, are not only dependent on the body itself. There's certainly a relationship, but that just because these particular four elements will deteriorate and stop and decompose. It just doesn't feel intuitively right to say that that's the end of it all. And I guess on a more practical level, and I think the Buddha actually even talks about this. He doesn't ask us to have a belief that we can't verify, but he asks us to consider, what it's like to hold a certain position and what the results of that are. So that's what I was saying. It's like using the idea of rebirth as a working hypothesis, so that, even though we can't verify through our own personal experience the truth of it, we can say, okay, well, let's assume, that there is that likelihood of rebirth. And so what does that result in if I take that assumption, if I make that assumption and believe it, or at least believe it as much as I can, then where does that take my mind? And it provides me with a sense of urgency, a sense of motivation, a sense of realizing that if if there is more than just this life, then I want to, if I don't find a complete end to suffering this time around, then I want to, hedge my bets in the direction for further growth and further opportunities in the next round. So I want to keep setting myself up from minute to minute and from life to life with a set of circumstances that are going to be conducive for realizing Dhamma, because I've had enough of suffering. So I think that's pretty much the motivation behind taking it on. It's not something, again, it's to be just accepted as a metaphysical theory. It's something to be used in contemplation, to bring it into our experience, to make it something that helps us move towards the end of suffering. It has a purpose. It's not just a belief. Would you like to add anything?
No. That's good. Okay. Next question is, can you please speak a bit about karma and volition? For instance, if an unwholesome thought, such as anger or fear, arises or wants to rise of its own accord in the mind, does one get unwholesome karma? Or is the bad karma produced only through the grasping or rejection of it? Or is bad karma produced only if action is taken? Or are different kinds of karma produced for thought versus action? Okay. So there, on a certain level, some of it, this is answered with what Ajahn Khrundamal said as well. One is actually make a distinction between karma and vipaka. Karma is the action, vipaka is the result. And the word karma, all that karma is the verb to do. So it's just a very simple verb. And so action, bodily action, verbal action, mental action. And then volition plays a very important role. And the word in Pali is jetana. And the Buddha is very explicit in saying that jetana is karma. Volition in English is maybe not quite the same, but it... Well, volition is probably the best word. Intention is not really a good word. Because it's sort of like volition is probably the best word in a sense, because volition implies a kind of a movement towards, an impulsion towards something. So then that it's that impulsion towards a particular action of body, speech, or mind results in vipaka, or that brings about a result. So that and the unwholesome thoughts, they have their own they have their own result in the sense that the more one thinks of something or thinks in a particular way, that pattern starts to get set, or it starts to gain momentum, so that there's a certain momentum arises. And then, of course, a familiarity of thinking in a particular way easily leads to actions of body or speech, so that it's easy to say or do something unkindly if one is constantly thinking thoughts of aversion and ill will. It's not complicated. It's not strange that would be the result. The results of action will have they have their own the potency, so that acting on something out of a minor irritation is very different than acting on something out of kind of a murderous rage. It has a different. It affects the mind differently. It's a different volition. It's a different different quality. So an act of extreme kindness or selflessness has tremendous results. It's quite natural. So the more say on both sides, and that's something usually when we say karma, it's oftentimes associated with as if it's bad karma, but karma is a neutral term, and there's lots of good karma that we can be doing, like taking 10-day retreats. That's really good karma. Okay, please talk about one, whole body breathing, two, choiceless awareness. Thank you, Ajahn Pasarno and Ajahn Kurundamo, for wonderfully helpful talks. There's sort of idioms that people use, and particular teachers use, or that have got into the vernacular of Buddhist teachings, it might mean something or have begun with a particular meaning, sometimes it's hard to tell what it actually means. So something like, I'm not sure who it is. Like whole body breathing, where that originated from, but certainly that sense of in the Anapanasati Sutta, experiencing the whole body, I breathe in, experiencing the whole body, I breathe out. Sabbangaya, sabba is sort of like all, whole, complete. Everything, sabba, so that the whole body. You breathe in, and you're attuning in to the whole body. So that whole body breathing, it's a One is, maybe using it as a way of enlivening the body process, energizing it, bringing awareness to the whole to the whole body, so that that is perhaps a way of explaining that. The idea of choiceless awareness is a bit of a non sequitur in terms of the way that the Buddha teaches mindfulness and mindfulness of breathing and foundations of mindfulness. There's a but I can see the if it's explained or the logic behind it is, I assume, and I don't know for sure, but I assume that using that idiom, it's kind of pointing to the trying to release the meditative control freak side of ourselves that is constantly judging, constantly commenting on how either poorly or greatly one is doing, so that stepping back from that, but I think it's important to recognize that we need to do that. We need to. There's a trust that we have to have in awareness, in our ability to be attentive to things. But we do need to exercise discernment and understand clearly that the mind is always making choices. And we need to be facilitating the choice of the wholesome, the skillful, the bright, the beneficial qualities of mind, so that there is a clear a growth and development, and the word that the Buddha uses for meditation is bhavana, and bhavana literally means to bring into being. So in bringing into being certain qualities and there needs to be some choice exercise because there's lots of qualities that are coming up. But I think there definitely needs to be a stepping back from that kind of obsession with control and getting things according to one's according to one's preference or one's concepts or one's ideas or ideals that one sets for what one thinks one should be doing, which can get very complicated. Okay, next question. Is contemplating the heart center a form of the second foundation of mindfulness? In the sense that is kind of a feeling center of our being, yes. But it's also, just as valid to contemplate the breath there, contemplate the sensation of the body there, the manifestation of the citta, dhammas. It's all. It's another place of experience so it can be utilized as well. It's like if you ask a Westerner where their jitta is, and they'll say right here. And if you ask a Thai person where their jitta is, and they'll say right here. It's a different base of experience. Okay. How does one work with one's own judgments that come up so often during the meditation practice? They are mostly judgments of myself for not getting there. So, this is from the monkey mind owner. One is the this is where metta bhavana is really important. That cultivation of loving kindness, a conscious, consistent, developing of that quality of loving kindness, well wishing, a goodwill, and it always starts towards oneself, laying that foundation within oneself of kindness and looking after oneself, because the judgments that come are oftentimes, if when one listens to them, so often you say, you wouldn't say that to your friends. This really, really very consciously and very overtly laying a foundation of loving kindness and that well wishing, goodwill as a basis, and that it's worth the effort at the very beginning of the meditation, and for as long as it takes till the heart really kind of brightens and becomes soft, because that's the judgments are there's kind of a hard edge to the mind that isn't really useful for practice, so that kind of softening and clarity and ease. There needs to be a certain ease and brightness in the mind for it to really be efficacious, for it to be effective. A distraction from the real practice. It is the real practice. Okay, it's just a request to, this one's easy to deal with. This is saying enjoying the instruction and Dhamma talk, but also asking if I could use the Pali words for some of the categories of the teachings and the instruction, so that there's a bit more clarity for the person to come back to the teachings with. I will try to endeavor to do that. Because, yeah, it's a, as I've mentioned, it's helpful to have some of these fundamental teachings and vocabulary in the scriptural language, because it gives one a bit more precision in how to what did the Buddha actually say? What did he teach? And what was it about?